Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's been almost 10 years since the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. In fact, today marks the 10th anniversary of the historic global protest against the war that took place all over the world. In 2003, today's guests, photojournalists Kale Alford and Thorne Anderson, took photos of Iraqi citizens outside of the confines of the U.S. military's embedded journalist program. Their goal was to find out how the war was affecting ordinary people. Their photos are on display at the de Young Museum in San Francisco. The description on a photo taken in Baghdad at a hospital on April 9, 2003, says a pool of blood is left on the floor of the lobby of the Saddam City Medical Center after a man died on a makeshift operating table. Located near the front lines, the hospital was overflowing with patients. Another photo taken in Najaf on August 21st, 2004, shows a man holding his crying son. The description reads, "On the wrecked outskirts of the old city, a father tries to cross the front lines with his terrified child, signaling to snipers to hold their fire. Father and son crossed safely." Thorne Anderson began his work in Iraq in October 2002, photographing the impact of UN sanctions on the lives of Iraqis. He spent 10 months of the last 2 years in, actually, that's not right. He was last in Iraq in 2004. While covering the war from Baghdad, he was arrested by Iraqi intelligence and expelled from the country. He returned to Iraq as soon as the borders opened at the end of the war and has covered the occupation resistance movements. He's also worked in the Balkans, Afghanistan, Israel, and Palestine. He's taught photojournalism at the American University in Bulgaria, and his photographs regularly appear in major American and international newspapers and magazines. And Thorne joins us here in studio. Hi, Thorne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Nice to see you. Nice. I just wanted to add to that I'm currently teaching at the University of North Texas.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Great. I think I took some info from different bios, and I think some of it's outdated.
Yeah, that's very bad at keeping those online bios up to date.
One bio said you spent the last 10 months, but that was from a while ago. So thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
We're also joined by Kale Alford, a freelance photojournalist who was based in Baghdad during the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. She was last in Iraq in 2011. Her work focuses on the growing culture of resistance, religion, and the grassroots movements developing since the invasion. She has worked extensively covering Southeast Europe and the Middle East for many major U.S. and European magazines. She's currently working on a long-term project about the environmental degradation, landscape, and culture of the Gulf Coast. And Kale also joins us in studio. Hi, thank you for coming on.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter or a photojournalist who did a good job this week. So what did you see this week that you thought was done well? And Thorne, why don't we start with you?
Well, just this morning, the World Press Photo Awards were announced out of Amsterdam. And I encourage everyone to look up worldpressphoto.org and see some of the best photojournalism from around the world. I mean, there's some amazing stuff there. I didn't have time to look at everything, but just glancing over it, you'll see photographs from Emin Osman, who photographed Syrian rebels interrogating a prisoner and torturing this prisoner. I mean, that's a really important kind of work to do, to be able to go deeply and into such a difficult place and to make a document that shows what that really looks like. I think there's also great work there from Thomas Munita, who embedded himself in El Salvadoran gangs and produced some amazing documentary work there. Paolo Pellegrin did some beautiful work from Rochester, New York, on rising violence in this very small part of Rochester called the Crescent, which has 20% of the population of Rochester, but 80% of its murders. And Aaron Huey also did some work that was honored in World Press Photo, where he revisited Native American communities for a story called In the Shadow of Wounded Knee. Huh. What's interesting about Aaron that I think is worth noting is that he originally did this story for National Geographic, And he published it. It was applauded, the quality of the work. But he got feedback from the community saying, we feel that you've misrepresented us, that you've represented us in a way that is one-dimensional. And he took that to heart and really, on his own initiative, went back into that community, listening to people, and opened himself to a new way of covering that community.
Wow, that would be a great show.
Yes.
To have him on and the people that gave him the feedback.
Yeah, and I think that's you know, it really speaks to a level of humility that I think all journalists need to have. I mean, we do our best, but we're always imperfect, and we have to listen to the people that we report on. And we have to respond to that. And I really, you know, want to give kudos to Aaron Huey for really going back and trying to do right by the people that he was photographing.
Interesting. I'd love to ask you more about that later in the show, because with social media, we now have direct access to journalists. And I wonder, what is the responsibility of journalists to respond to this kind of feedback? That's really interesting. Thank you. And we'll include links to these photos on our website right after the show.
Sure.
What about you, Kale? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, this isn't specifically, it's not journalism, but it's reporting done by Human Rights Watch. They just, every year they publish a sort of world report based on what happened in the last year. And as I was researching and preparing to speak to audiences about Iraq, I came across their report, which goes into some depth about what's happened in Iraq in the last year. And although I was there in 2011, it's nice to see, I'm confirmed what in this report is what I saw in Iraq in 2011, which is that the leadership of Iraq is, and I'm quoting the report here, so the intro to the report, is using draconian measures against opposition politicians, detainees, demonstrators, and journalists, effectively squeezing the space for independent civil society and political freedoms in Iraq. Human Rights said this today in their world report, and this was just published in the end of January. And so, there just isn't a huge amount of reporting coming out of Iraq these days by Western media, because budgets are shrinking, there are lots of conflicts happening all over the world, and our attention shifts elsewhere. And, you know, we were just speaking about this before the show, how 10 years on the anniversary of this war, we don't really know what's happening in Iraq. We don't know what it looks like.
Right. I remember on MSNBC, one of the hosts said, President Obama has announced that the war in Iraq is over. The troops are leaving. Sort of end of story.
Right.
So you went there last year. Just talk about when you go, where do you go? And what do you set out to do? What did you find this time around?
Well, I had a short period of time to work there. I only had a few weeks, and actually my time was shortened even by having trouble getting my visa through. So I had this window to work, and I decided the best way to catch up with what had happened since I was there last would be to take the photographs I made and to revisit as many of the people as I could in these photographs, or people who I'd met in the past and reported on in the past. So I sort of systematically went searching for these people, and it was like detective work, because the country was so upended in those last years that I didn't know where to find anyone. I didn't know if they're living in the same neighborhood. They certainly didn't have the same phone numbers and
these
email
are the
addresses.
The people that you have gotten to know over the years.
Right, the people who I met in 2003 and 2004. And, you know, I hadn't really kept in close contact with them. It was just difficult. Many of them don't speak English, or not very well, don't write English. So, and I don't speak or read Arabic. So when I went back, I found these people and discovered, and just sort of asked them, what's happened in the last 8 years since I was here last? How is your life? What are your concerns? And almost universally, people's lives had gotten much, much harder. The situation was violent. It was very divided. You know, people couldn't live safely in the places they'd lived before. The Sunni people who I met, many of them, you know, they felt sort of confined to specific neighborhoods. There really was this ethnic divide, this ethnic cleansing that targeted mostly Sunnis. They're in the minority now, were the subject of that. And so Sunni people were really living in much more cloistered circumstances than they lived before, if I could even find them at all. There's one woman, her name's Karima, and she and her family, I'd spent time at their house a lot in 2003 and 2004, and she's a widow, and her husband was killed in the Iran-Iraq war. She has a large number of kids, and I went to visit her, and her son, her oldest son, Ali, had been picked up at a cafe in a raid when there were sort of these Iraqi security forces were looking for members of the Sadr militia. They picked him up, detained him, didn't charge him with anything really, and interrogated him extracting a confession from him, and then proceeded to sort of keep him in prison until the family sold everything they had and could buy him out of prison, basically. Uh-huh. And that speaks to the state of the Iraqi judicial system today. I mean, it's a confession-based sort of system, and people are frequently detained and not charged with anything until people can just buy them out. And that's included in this Human Rights Watch report. So it was really the biggest concerns for people were coming out from this new, very sort of corrupt and ineffective Iraqi government, in their words, you know, the way they described it. And also the infrastructure was just a mess.
You know, tell us more about that, because we've done, just over the years, we've done a lot of shows about the infrastructure. And I remember we used to have a series, Open Line to Iraq, and we'd bring Iraqis on a regular basis. And the first question was, do you have electricity? Do you have water? And it was so sporadic.
So sporadic. I mean, the grid supplies maybe 6 hours of power a day, the sort of national grid. And otherwise, there are these neighborhood generators that are either privately owned by one wealthy person in the neighborhood that sells energy to everybody else, that produces it and sells it to everyone else at whatever price they decide to set. At least when I was there, they were talking about regulating this generator system, but it wasn't happening yet when I was there. And then sometimes a neighborhood will go in together and buy a generator, and they can be sort of a more grassroots sort of democratic use of the generator. And these are the very large generators, like the size of shipping containers, that would sit every few blocks and were constantly running and spewing fumes. They run on petroleum, you know, and they smell terrible and they're loud. And then people would have a little generator at their house if they were wealthy enough to have their own generator that they would run when both those other systems weren't working.
And, you know, it's important to note, we're not talking about an earthquake or some other kind of natural disaster. What we're talking about here is a disaster of just massive corruption, because there have been billions and billions of dollars that have been poured in for the rebuilding of Iraq's infrastructure, and that has not been realized. That money has gone into Iraq, but it hasn't gone into the infrastructure.
That's a good point.
So, you know, we're not talking about a natural disaster here. We're talking about a really poorly managed transition of huge amounts of money.
And so when you went there, Cale, in 2011, how are you received? And what is the process like when you try to tell this story through photographs?
Well, you know, photographs are this strange animal. They have this immediate emotional power. We read them very quickly, and we come away with an impression very quickly. And I think they can be quite effective at making a human and emotional connection, and even an intellectual connection with a subject. But it's a slice of the story. It's this fleeting moment in time. We don't know what comes before, what comes after a photograph. And so it is always a challenge for me to try to tell the story in the depth I would like to tell it, simply with photography, which is why I think both Thorne and I often include text with our photographs and try to give some context to what those photographs mean or where they come from. But when I was returning with these pictures and seeking them, sometimes I'd find people I'd never actually spoken to before, or I'd spoken to only for a short period of time, and I'd try to find them again, and I'd show them this picture, and they swore they remembered me, which was really funny because I couldn't imagine they actually did. They probably saw it, but maybe I was the only Westerner they saw. Maybe they actually did remember me. And they were really happy. People were really happy that I thought about them again, that, you know, that people from outside Iraq were taking a moment to take, going to some effort to seek them out and ask them questions about their lives.
And Thorne, you began your work in Iraq in October 2002, photographing the impact of UN sanctions on the lives of Iraqis. Why did you, what was it about Iraq that piqued your interest?
Well, pardon me. Well, you know, I started planning to go to Iraq on the day of the attacks on 9/11. As I remember watching those attacks on my TV screen, I was covering the civil war in Macedonia at the time, and thinking, what does that mean for me as a journalist? And so purely out of kind of sort of professional and, you know, personal kind of ambition, I thought, well, the big story is going to be in the next war. And that war's, even though I already understood on that day that the attacks probably came from Osama bin Laden, I had seen the intense lobbying efforts from the Iraqi National Congress over the preceding months for action on Iraq, and I knew that those had been gaining traction. So I immediately started planning to go to Iraq, thinking that this would have some consequence. And so I went to Iraq thinking I was going to cover, you know, the build-up to war. But when I got there, I realized that I didn't know anything about Iraq. I didn't understand really the depth of the impact that the sanctions had had on Iraq, and I was deeply embarrassed by that, because I was a journalist, and I read news obsessively. And I didn't really understand how messed up that country had become because of 12 years of sanctions between the two U.S. invasions. And that really humbled me, and it made me realize that I needed to pay attention to what was happening around me in Iraq, and not so much to, I guess, our sort of Western ideas of what was happening, because at that time the news was really dominated by this sort of cartoonish figure of Saddam Hussein.
Right.
Of course, you know, he was a dictator, we all understand this, but that's all that we could talk about when we talked about Iraq, and I realized that the real story was in the lives of individual Iraqi people.
That is Thorne Anderson. He began his work in Iraq in October 2002 as he's talking about photographing the impact of sanctions on the lives of Iraqis. He was last there in 2004. Cale Alford was based in Baghdad during the U.S. invasion in 2003. She was last in Iraq in 2011. And their photographs are currently on display at the DeYoung Museum. In fact, if you go to our Facebook page or yourcallradio.org, you can see these photographs and find out more about the exhibit. Also, Cale and Thorne are giving a talk tonight at the San Francisco Art Institute, 800 Chestnut Street in San Francisco. Tickets are available at the door, $10 for the public, $5 for students. And Thorne and Cale decided to do this work unembedded, and we'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes. But if do you have any comments or questions about coverage of Iraq? Next month is going to be the, actually it's April, the 10-year anniversary of Iraq. Today actually marks the 10-year anniversary of the historic protests that took place around the world. We saw massive protests in San Francisco, New York, London, South Korea, Thailand, Brazil. So many countries around the world protested this war 10 years ago today. So there's probably, even though there's not much coverage about Iraq now, there will be coverage in April marking the 10-year anniversary. What do you want from that coverage at a time when so many of the budgets are being cut and there aren't very many reporters? In fact, Cale, did you run into any other reporters in Baghdad? Do you know how many are there?
There were other reporters there. And committed reporters from major news organizations in the U.S. I mostly saw some newspaper reporters from the L.A. Times and also from the Washington Post. They both had some people still in Baghdad at that point. And their NPR had correspondents coming in and out, but Syria was really just sort of picking up, and so there was a lot of attention there with the mainstream media at
right.
that point.
And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. When you reflect back on 10 years, what really stands out for you in media coverage? And also when we're talking about photographs, talk a little bit about the power of photographs and what photos can tell us about what it's like for ordinary citizens in the middle of a war zone. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So why don't you both talk about your decision to do this work unembedded? So you were not going around with the American forces. You were connected with locals. When did you first decide to do it like this?
Well, I mentioned that I had understood early that I that the media coverage that I had seen had not really illuminated Iraq for me, but had kind of obscured it. This obsessive focus on Saddam Hussein had actually made me understand Iraq less well and not better. And so my reaction to that was to kind of throw myself as far as I could go into the lives of ordinary Iraqi people. And I'd already been practicing that while working on the sanctions stories, because that was the best way to tell that story. And so by the time the shock and awe campaign and the invasion came about, I had already established contacts among ordinary Iraqi people, and I saw this invasion not only of U.S. forces, but of journalists who came in with those forces. And Baghdad was suddenly transformed. It had hundreds of journalists, and so many of them were traveling with the American and the British and other coalition forces, that I realized that there was this sort of niche that needed to be tended to, and that was reporting completely outside the confines of the military experience. Now, I'm not one of these people who thinks that embedding with journalism with the American forces is inherently bad. It's a great way to do stories about the American experience. And it's a good way to do stories about certain American military actions, house raids, and things like that. But if you want to do a story about what this war means for Iraqi people, it's just impossible to do if you're embedded. You can't even have a normal conversation with an Iraqi person when you're surrounded by these, you know, giant soldiers and their body armor, and they're carrying their automatic weapons, and they're traveling in these giant vehicles. You just can't even have a conversation, much less have an intimate experience with them and photograph them in the kinds of settings that we were seeking.
And at the DeYoung Museum, in a display case, there are the military rules and protocols for journalists. It says, here's a document one must sign in order to be embedded with troops. It includes some language about images or wounded or dead troops, the point at which images can be released, and other restrictions on militarily sensitive information. So journalists actually have to sign a document. And what are they promising to do or not do?
Well, that document is always changing, and this is part of the problem. It's enormous. It's, I think, 16, 15 pages of this small single space type. And I would be surprised if anything more than maybe 10% of the people who sign it actually read the whole thing, because it's like reading, you know, the agreement on the iTunes store when you download the latest update. It's just very hard to get through it, and the agreements are always changing. And I think as the experience of an embedded reporter is not so much that document as the confusion of not knowing exactly what it is that's going to get you kicked out. And you may have the best intentions as a reporter, but you really know that you need to have that access to get to your story, and you may find yourself sort of restraining yourself a little bit just to make sure that you can maintain that access, and that can have a sort of creeping effect over time. Now, that said, a lot of reporters do challenge that, and they do reporting that either slides under the radar or does get them kicked out of their embeds, which happens quite a bit as well.
Yeah, I have not worked as an embedded journalist myself. I haven't officially been embedded with U.S. troops because I just chose to stay on the Iraqi side, and I thought it would actually interfere for me to be embedded with U.S. troops. But I do know colleagues who've done really good in reporting from embeds, but I also know colleagues who've been kicked out and not been able to go back after doing that sort of challenging reporting.
What are your thoughts on what the embed process has done, or how has it shaped our perception of what goes on? Patrick Coburn had a piece in which he wrote, perhaps the most damaging effect of embedding is to soften the brutality of any military occupation and underplay hostile local responses to it.
Well, I mean, it's been very well researched what embedded reporting does. And I think if you look at any communications journal, professional journal, and look at the research on the impact of embedded journalism, there's no question that work that comes out of embeds is generally more favorable and sympathetic to the point of view and policies of the military. And that's the intent of the program. I mean, the program was invented in order to create a place for journalists to go and get information about U.S. troop action that's accurate and also influenced by the U.S. military, you know, communications machinery.
Yeah, and also after the break, we'll talk about how one U.S. officer responded to your work, accusing you in a New York Times editorial of putting American soldiers at risk. And then we're also going to talk about, I didn't even know this existed, but we found this piece over at Borderzine about journalism students training as embedded journalists for the Army at Fort Bliss, Texas. Fascinating story that journalists are actually training how to be embedded reporters. Today we are talking with independent photojournalists Thorne Anderson and Kale Alford. They covered the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And it's your calls, Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this.
All of the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org, and they're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org, and you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thank you.
is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will be live on the air, and we'll have a conversation about whether the Obama administration is planning to approve or deny approval of the Keystone XL pipeline. This is the $7 billion, 1,700-mile pipeline that is scheduled to transport tar sands from Alberta, Canada, to the Gulf Coast. A number of people were arrested in front of the White House protesting the Keystone Pipeline on Wednesday. And then on Sunday, there are going to be major protests across the country. In fact, there's going to be one of the largest ever environmental actions in Washington on Sunday. And you can find more information about that. We'll put some information on our Facebook page. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the power of photography during war. We're speaking with independent photojournalists Thorne Anderson and Cale Alford. They covered the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, Unembedded, and in April. It's going to be the 10-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. In fact, today marks the 10-year anniversary of the massive protests that took place around the world. Cale and Thorne were both unembedded. They wanted to really tell the story from the point of view of ordinary, everyday Iraqis, how the invasion affected their lives. Their photos are now on display at the DeYoung Museum in San Francisco, and they're giving a talk tonight at the San Francisco Art Institute at 7:30, 800 Chestnut Street, $10 for the public and $5 for students. And when you look back and reflect on 10 years of war, what really stands out for you when it comes to media coverage? I often think about Colin Powell's speech, Condoleezza Rice talking about the mushroom cloud, and how the media covered those really important events over the past 10 years. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Shahram in Oakland. Hi, Shahram. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning, Rose, and good morning to your guests. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for this very timely program that you're doing today. And I want to commend and salute the work of the photographers that you have, the artists. I happened to see their work at the Young Museum last week, and the images were very striking. It was very moving. And I wish I had a little more time to look at them more thoroughly. Unfortunately, I couldn't. What I wanted to ask your guest today was this. I don't know who it was that said this. I remember it was a South American novelist, I believe. He was arguing that sometimes when you're trying to capture the reality in your work, the reality is so harsh. The horror outside is so striking, and the situation outside your work in the objective situation is so horrifying that it kind of debilitates the artist to capture those in his or her work. So I wonder if your guests had these moments when they're looking at the photographs later on or while they were shooting these images.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, absolutely. And thank you very much for, visiting the show and saying such nice things about it. I appreciate that. But it's actually kind of sort of a professional tool, I guess, for a lot of journalists that you kind of learn ways to distance yourself emotionally from what's happening in front of you. In the long term, I think that's actually as a person, it's not healthy. And I think a lot of journalists feel the effects of that. Over many years, distancing yourself from what should be an ordinary sense of outrage or, horror at what happens in front of your camera. But in the short term, to enable you to do your job, I think it's something that all journalists do. Maybe Cale has a different perspective on that.
Well, I mean, it's I can relate to the feeling that the quote that you gave us or the paraphrase you gave us that, there's nothing I can show that really shows the depth of how disturbing this thing is. But So to speak to it from an artistic or aesthetic point of view, I mean, I try to sort of show images that are surprising or give you a kind of image of what horror is. That's sometimes it's even a quieter moment than you would expect, just so that the viewer can sort of connect with it or imagine it in their own world or their own lives in some way. But it's a huge challenge for us, and it's what we always struggle with.
And what are you able to do in an exhibit? Because in this particular exhibit, there is a storyline chronologically, and you sort of see things get worse. But as you said, there are the quiet moments. So what can you do in an exhibit to try to connect more dots?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think this exhibit, it's been curated so lovingly by Julian Cox, the curator at the De Young, and with such attention to the content of the images and the relationships between them. So I think, you know, for this group of images, I can't imagine it really being displayed any more effectively than it is. And what I think is valuable, what we really tried to do was to not include only these moments of horror, but also the ordinary moments of life and these brief reprieves that happen in between moments of horror, because that in some way is really more an accurate representation of what life is and what life is like, even for these people there. And I would feel I was being unfair to them if I didn't represent also the kind of resilience that people have and their, you know, willingness to continue to engage in spite of really difficult situations around them. And when I went back to visit people in 2011, I found exactly that. I had this notion that, you know, everything that had happened in their lives was really so challenging in so many ways. And yet what they wanted for me in our time together was to sit down and share a meal and tell stories and joke. And, you know, the girls wanted to do my nails. And I mean, it was just so lovely. And
but do you think that's part of the problem? Because there's such a disconnect between the U.S. and the countries that it bombs, because the media image that we're given is, you know, screaming men. I mean, we've seen these stereotypes, the women in the chadors screaming, but you don't see the humanity of just everyday people.
I think so. I think that humanity, that everyday humanity of people, is the thing that connects us the most, you know. And it's, we live in such a strange time where we have the power to bomb countries from an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf hundreds of miles away, while we all, you know, visit movie theaters and have dinner and live a normal life. And that kind of, I think it is the personal experience that we're lacking with each other.
Well, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because it reminds me of the drones. I mean, you're able mm-hmm. to deal with a drone or set off a drone in Las Vegas that lands on someone's home in Pakistan. How do you capture that image?
Right.
When there's no one on the ground other than the people being killed.
Which is a really huge problem for journalists, I think, and for us as citizens in this modern age of modern warfare. If drones and these sort of secret wars are going to be the thing that dominates our foreign policy, we'll be stuck with not knowing what that looks like on the ground. And many journalists who have attempted to write about those consequences, some, you know, to great danger and peril to themselves, like was it David Rode for the New York Times, mm-hmm. who spent time in northern Pakistan, and mm-hmm. and he wrote so effectively about the consequences of those drone strikes and the attitudes of people towards Americans, the anti-Americanism that was being inflamed, and it was like sort of a recruiting tool for the most radical elements of the Taliban.
Yeah, I'm just thinking it'd be an amazing photo essay to go to the countries that are dealing with these drones to let Americans know what they're doing, right? Because we don't know. I mean, there's no, some soldiers there, but it's such a different form of warfare. What are your thoughts
right,
on that?
Right, and it's, I mean, how do you get to those remote places as a journalist? And these are places where Americans are not looked on very kindly because they're, you know, shelling from the, bombing from the air at this great distance, and civilians are being injured. It's a very difficult problem for us.
Are your colleagues talking about this, especially photographers?
Well, the drone strikes are largely happening in the tribal territories of northern Pakistan, and I have traveled through those tribal territories before, and it makes me extraordinarily nervous. It's a really difficult and dangerous place to work for a whole, you know, for centuries of reasons. It's a difficult place to work because it's large. You know, it's not even controlled by the Pakistani state, you know, much less by any other kind of, you know, the Americans certainly have no control there. So it's just a very, very difficult place to work. I know that a lot of journalists would like to work there, and right now it's just been very difficult. But, you know, to speak to this earlier question about showing the horror of something, I think it's what makes something really horrible is if you can identify with the victims of this attack. And I think that's what we try to do by showing the sort of more humane side of something, and which is why these secret drone strikes, in fact, are so hideous, because you can't actually see the human face on the other end of that.
We're speaking with independent photojournalists Thorne Anderson and Kale Alford. They covered the U.S. invasion of Iraq and occupation of Iraq. We are coming on to the 10-year anniversary. Today is the 10-year anniversary of the massive protests that took place around the world. I remember covering this. Downtown San Francisco was completely shut down because of these protests. Their photos are currently on display. It's a traveling exhibit. It is now at the De Young in San Francisco. It'll be there until June 16th. It's called Eye Level in Iraq. And Kale and Thorne are giving a talk tonight at the San Francisco Art Institute, 730, 800 Chestnut Street in San Francisco. Tickets are $10. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join our conversation as we're talking about Iraq 10 years later, what really stands out for you in terms of media coverage, and what do you want the media to focus on when this 10-year anniversary rolls around next month? You can email feedback at yourcallradio.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And let's go to Marie-Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, Marie-Louise. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. Yeah, I definitely want to go and see these photos. Thank you. And I wanted to say that I feel like one of the hardest things about living through these wars, one war after another, it is that people in this country do not seem to be in solidarity with the troops, for example. Now, I am not a person who wished to have any military at all, if we could avoid it. But I do think that when a country goes to war time and again, the rest of life shouldn't just be trotting on as if nothing is happening. And that is mostly how it is here. And then I just wanted to add one other thing. A person said to me in Sweden when I was visiting at one time, and it just came out, she said, how come Americans fight all their wars on other people's land? Well, clearly we don't fight a war on our own land unless it's a civil war. But I still found it sort of a strong comment, the way it came out. And you were referring to anti-Americanism, and I think there's a lot of ignorance in this country about what other people actually think of what the United States does. Thank you very much, and I will be wanting to see those photos.
All right, well, thank you. Again, it's at the De Young Museum until June 16th, so you have a few months to check it out. Thank you, Marie-Louise. Comments?
Well, I mean, that last statement, yes, that we don't have a very clear idea of what people think about us in other parts of the world. I mean, it's really shocking to travel. And most Americans don't get the opportunity to travel for many reasons. It's a long way, first of all. But there really is a lot of suspicion and negative sort of stereotypes about who Americans are based on our foreign policy. And that comes back to haunt us.
I think, you know, one of the biggest problems that we in this country have with Iraq is that we think about this war entirely in sort of Americentric terms, and it's very it's difficult for us to imagine how this war would feel from the point of view of someone who is the target of these bomb attacks or these house raids. And that was really our hope in the work that we did in Iraq, was to kind of show things from the other point of view. And we even went so far as to find our way into insurgent groups and to photograph what things looked like from that side, not to celebrate these people as heroes or anything like that, because that's not our role as journalists, but just to try and diversify the perspectives on what this war looks like. And by the way, I just have to say, since, you know, both callers have mentioned the exhibit at the De Young, that the De Young is pretty I think it's noteworthy that they've been very brave in showing this work. It's not usual for photojournalism to be shown in an art museum at all, and particularly work that can be as touchy as this.
Elaborate on that word brave. Are you saying that you don't think other museums would show these photos? And if not, why?
I think, well, first off, just, you know, art museums, photojournalism hasn't traditionally found an easy home in art museums.
Not just contemporary photojournalism, historical photojournalism.
Yes.
After about 50 years is when it becomes safe enough to show.
Huh. Right, exactly. So, I mean, already right there, you know, the de Young is taking some sort of risk. And beyond that, you know, the fact that this is such a politically and emotionally charged experience, the Iraq War, that I think it shows, you know, that de Young is taking some risks by putting the show on and leaving it up there for 4 months. I mean, that's not, it's going to be hard to make that happen in let's say, Dallas, Texas, where I live. It's not so easy.
Well, this is a traveling exhibit.
It's not a traveling exhibit. I mean, I would like for it to be, but...
Well, it's been in Seattle and any other places?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So we have, to be clear, we have shown this work in small community centers, university galleries, and other places,
okay,
but really very much sort of under the radar of the mainstream art world. So it has made its rounds. But.
And that was a previous exhibit that involved other photography.
That's right. It involved Rita Leisner and Haith Abdullahad.
I mean, it's kind of amazing that you say that the de Young is taking a risk in San Francisco for showing these photos of, you know, a man carrying his crying child or blood in a hospital. I mean, they're horrific photos.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you think that says about where we are right now?
Well, I mean, you know, you have to remember we live in Dallas, Texas, so maybe it seems riskier from our perspective than it does from yours sitting in San Francisco. But I think that what that means is that we still haven't really completely come to terms with the implications of this war, both the political and the moral implications of the war. I think we're still wrestling with it. And I think that'll go on for a long time, and I'm happy to continue to be part of that struggle.
Well, we have time for just a few more calls. Again, the photographs are on display at the de Young Museum until June 16th, and you can take a look at these photos at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear next from Mike in Carmel. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How you doing? I'm looking forward to see those photos. I just got back from Iraq on February 3rd. It was my third time there as a program manager, this time for the State Department.
A program manager. What does that mean exactly?
That means that you manage a different project for the Department of Defense or for the State Department. You're in charge of a bunch of people doing a task. This last task was for managing what was called the Linguist Support Services, which are a bunch of interpreters that vet people that will be working in our embassy in Iraq.
And how many government employees are currently in Iraq at any given time? Do you know, Mike?
Well, I know the embassy started out this year at about 10,000, and it's looking to drop down to about 5,000 this year alone, if not more. So it's an incredible story to see. You know, I was there in 2005 and 2007 during the full-blown occupation, and to see that footprint of Americans compared to the little footprint now was amazing to me. I just want to say it's.
What do you think of the stories you're hearing from Thorne and Kale about the stories they wanted to tell through the eyes of Iraqis?
Well, I think it's totally legitimate, and their stories are totally accurate. And the thing is the media now, as in the past, just tries to ignore the real story of Iraq through the eyes of the Iraqis. All, you know, ever since my three tours there as a contractor, I work closely with Iraqis, and I very much respect them, and very intelligent, and they always treated me well, and they and me were just dumbfounded by the attitude Americans take towards them.
Huh. What do you mean by that?
Well, yeah, a lot of the folks that I worked with, you know, they were military folks, or they were basically confined to what I call the castle of the embassy, never getting out of the walls, and they think that the Iraqis are extremely uncivilized and uneducated, and, you know, it's just the complete opposite. They're very civilized. They've been civilized longer than my ancestors.
Since the beginning of civilization, literally.
Exactly.
Wow.
But I just wanted to, I guess my major comment is that, you know, having just come from there, I just see it's just another Benghazi waiting to happen.
That's awful to hear that. Well, thank you for calling, Mike, and thanks for that important perspective. This is what we need to hear, because this is what's happening on the ground. Before we let you both go, as we're about to head into the 10-year anniversary, and we will get some media coverage, how do you think the media should reflect on the last 10 years?
Well, there was a comment by an earlier caller. She said, you know, that we should show solidarity with the troops during a time of war. And I think if I understood what she was trying to say is that we should be sure that, or I'll take it from my point of view, we should really be sure that when we send people who are willing to die for their country into harm's way, we want to be sure we're doing it for a really carefully considered reason. And I think about, you know, all this, the coverage we get from troops and about the U.S. troops in this country and all the, you know, the sacrifices that people have made. And it really makes me just as sad, honestly, to think about all that's been lost by our people and, you know, during this war as it does for what's happened to the Iraqis. And I would really hope, though, that the Iraqi perspective, though, does get a little bit more attention on the anniversary and the current situation of what's happening in Iraq today, what it looks like, and what the fallout is of this conflict.
As I'm looking at the coverage of Iraq, I see a lot of sort of focus on the surge and this very poorly informed discussion of the impact of the surge and reducing it to these kind of very simplistic terms of having turned a corner in Iraq. And what I would like the coverage to be is to look at Iraq as a country of 26 million people and just ask what happened there and not obsessively evaluate whether or not the Americans won or lost, but let's look at what the impact was of this invasion and give up this obsession that we have with ourselves of having, of declaring ourselves a winner or a loser, and just look at what happened.
Well, we'll definitely do that. We'll have on some guests that we've had over the last 10 years to find out what their lives are like in Iraq. Thorn Anderson and Kale Alford are independent photojournalists who covered the invasion and occupation as unembedded photojournalists. And you can see their photos at the de Young Museum on display until June 16th, Eye Level in Iraq. And they're giving a talk tonight at 7:30 at the San Francisco Art Institute, 800 Chestnut Street in San Francisco. Tickets are $10. And be sure to also check out their photos online at yourcallradio.org. Thorn and Kale, thank you so much for coming in. Thanks for your work.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. And we've got just about 5 minutes left, and I'd like to welcome Max Blumenthal to the show. Max is a journalist and author, former senior writer with the Daily Beast. He's author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. And Max, welcome to the show.
To be on.
Hey, it's great to have you. We've got just 5 minutes, but we wanted to bring you on because we were struck by the piece you recently wrote for Alternet called How Law Enforcement and Media Covered Up the Plan to Burn Christopher Dorner Alive. This is the former LA cop who also served in the military, allegedly killed 4 people. And there's been a lot of questions about what happened when he died on Tuesday. Just give us the overall gist of your piece. You were closely following the police scanner as San Bernardino sheriffs gave the order to burn down the cabin.
Yeah, there should be no question about why Chris Dorner died the way he did. As I listened to the police scanners, I heard them, quote-unquote, deploy the burners, and then they said, we have a fire, because their intention was to set the cabin on fire. The burners are either incendiary or pyrotechnic tear gas rounds that can heat up a place to like 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Then I listened as they carefully managed the fire, making sure it penetrated into the basement where they believed Dorner was hiding. The intention all along was to burn Dorner alive. At the same time, the Sheriff's Department of San Bernardino requested that local media stop tweeting details. So while I was tweeting, the local media, like Riverside Press Enterprise, KABC, the local LA affiliate, announced that they were complying with this order, as though Dorner was somehow following Twitter to monitor police movements. Helicopter cameras, news helicopters zoomed out under request from the sheriff. And so the media imposed a blackout on itself, self-censored, allowing the deputies to proceed with their plan to commit what I consider to be an extrajudicial execution. And finally, the sheriff's sources have lied to the Los Angeles Times and claimed there was a constant barrage of gunfire from the cabin. I listened all along. The only report on police scanners was of a single shot from inside the cabin, which was likely Dorner killing himself. After that, there was nothing but unloaded ammunition exploding. And so what we're seeing here is a cover-up into the circumstances of Christopher Dorner's death, and the media not doing, the mainstream media not investigating.
And Max, we just have about a minute left. What else stands out for you? We noticed that there was rarely a mention of Dorner serving in the military. And then I also noticed when he released his manifesto, that didn't really enter into the narrative until about 4 or 5 days later.
Yeah, what stands out is that the man at the center of his narrative, Christopher Gettler, delivered a deposition validating Dorner's central claim and his central grievance. What stands out is that there are other manifestos from other cops saying Dorner was right about the culture of abuse and impunity inside the LAPD while they disagreed with him killing people,
right,
as I do.
Right.
And I have been on radio shows where cops have called in to say Dorner was right. I've experienced the same things in the LAPD. Of course, he was wrong to kill people. So what I would say is Dorner is no hero. But we have to ask why people tried to make him into a hero. And we have to also say that the real villains are those who sought to deny, who believe he deserved no due process.
And I understand that a few former cops are actually planning to give talks about this.
Yeah, I mean, the police are frustrated, too, and they don't like to be a party to this kind of culture of impunity. And I think, you know, there needs to be more examination, watchdogs, on how the mainstream media covered it. I mean, in the day after, every major outlet from AP to the New York Times to LA Times reported in the passive voice that the cabin was burned and that they didn't know how. But they were listening to the same scanners I was, and they know how it was burned down.
Well,
they self-censored.
Well, Max, thank you so much for joining us. Max Blumenthal has a piece out in Alternet, how law enforcement and media covered up the plan to burn Christopher Dorner alive. And we will definitely follow this story. Thank you, Max, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening. And I also want to thank Molly Spina, our incredible intern, who's done a great job doing excellent research for the show over the past 2 months and doing social media. Thank you so much, Molly. We'll miss you. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up on Monday. Will the Obama administration approve or deny approval of the Keystone XL pipeline project? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about efforts to pressure the administration to reject the pipeline and instead address the climate crisis. The $7 billion, 1,700-mile pipeline would transport tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada to the Gulf Coast. So what is the current position of the administration? Who's pushing for this project? And how are groups working to stop it? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.